Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, February 3rd, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. More about that during the second half of the show. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. As for this hour, I'll be talking to two guests. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with debut author Tracy Robert. But first up, novelist Rachel Cantor. Rachel was raised in Rome in Connecticut. She's the author of the novel A Highly Unlikely Scenario, and her short stories have appeared in The Paris Review, One Story, Ninth Letter, and The Kenyon Review, among other publications. Her latest novel, hot off the press, is Good on Paper. It's published by Melville House Publishing, and I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Rachel.
Hi, Nicole. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, pleased you could join us. And so why don't we start off by having you introduce this book to us? Would you tell us what it's about?
Certainly. So Good on Paper is about Shira Green. Shira Green is the narrator of the book. She's a single mother who lives in New York City with her 7-year-old daughter, Andy, and her best friend, Ahmad. And Ahmad acts as her daughter's de facto father. So they've created a little unconventional family for themselves, which works quite well for the most part. So Shira is a translator, but she doesn't translate very much because she's not sure she believes in the possibility of intimate connection between author and translator, or really between anyone for that matter, and that issue is very much at the heart of this book. So she doesn't translate very much. In fact, she mostly spends her time temping for marginal businesses in New York City, mostly in the boroughs, because she doesn't type well enough to work in Manhattan. She's stunned when she receives a word from a Nobel Prize-winning poet who wants her to translate his latest work. He gives her a more or less plausible reason for choosing her, and Shira is elated and begins imagining new life for herself and for her daughter. But when this poet, whose name is Romé, when Romé begins to send her sections of his work, she and we begin to suspect that he has another agenda, one that involves her personally. So broadly speaking, the book Good on Paper is a novel about family ties and friendship and forgiveness and whether it's possible to begin again and how we learn to love.
Yeah, you had me from the beginning with this book because of the...
How so?
Well, the focus on language. I love that she's a translator and that she has issues with it and the way that you leverage that for an exploration about you know, communication and also translation. And so I'd love to start, though, by asking, you know, why Dante? So what drew you? Because he plays his work. And
yeah. Well, there's both a personal explanation for that and also a narrative reason for that. I read a lot of Dante when I was young, so his work was not influential exactly, but it made an impression. So I read a lot of his work in high school and then again in college. So for me, Dante's on my mind rather a lot. But for the purposes of the book, Romé is an Italian-speaking poet. He's actually from Romania, but he writes in Italian. And for him, or for any poet, I imagine, who is concerned for his place in the literary canon, Dante is a towering figure and somebody that he would want to be in dialogue with, if not to kind of supersede, if that were possible. So it's natural that he would have an interest in Dante, and the book Good on Paper is concerned specifically not with the Divine Comedy, but with an early work of Dante called Vita Nuova, which means new life. And that book is particularly relevant in this context because Romé, the Italian poet in the novel, is concerned not just with spiritual redemption, which is the theme of the Divine Comedy, but with love, with telling a love story. And that's what Vita Nuova does. It tells a story about a life made new by love, which is the story of how Dante met Beatrice and how Beatrice inspired his poems. And so this book by Romé is going to be about his wife and about how she inspired his writings.
Right. And Shira does seem, I don't know if we'd call her cynical, but I she does look at love from, it's, I feel like she's walking around the room of love and taking looks at it from different angles and trying to wrap her head around it. But I, with translation, so in the intro, I talked about how you grew up both in Rome and in the United States. So you must be bilingual.
Oh, I wish.
Oh, okay.
wish. I'm glad if you think after reading my book that I have a strong grasp on Italian.
Well, you
that means I succeeded to a certain extent. I speak some Italian. It's been many, many years since I lived there. I was there from age 10 through 15, and I went to American school, so Italian was a subject I studied rather than something that I naturally spoke fluently, and it's been 15 years since I've even been in the country, and so my Italian is not fluent, and I'm not bilingual, but I do have a reasonable understanding, and enough to make my way through some Italian texts with the help of a dictionary. And I wish, though. Shira spent less time in Rome than I did, but miraculously, her Italian is exceptionally good.
Well, I'm surprised at that, just because of this. Because you go into different theories of translation, and you go pretty deep there. And so, how did you research then the art of translation and approaches and that sort of thing?
Well, it was a two-part, I suppose. One part was actually doing research, reading books about translation, both from a theoretical and a practical perspective. What do people think about the project of translation, philosophers, other authors, poets, and so on, and specifically, how do they do it? What do they do, and what are the challenges to translating in Italian? This is not something that I would have known myself, but I did read a number of articles and essays and anthologies about that. And then, second of all, just sort of imagining, using my imagination to figure out what it might be like to actually be confronted with a text that's, you know, not your own, and which is complex, especially in this case of the work that Shira is asked to translate. It's very complex. There's lots of layers to it. And imagine what she has to do in order to really deeply understand and appreciate and be able to translate his words. So both research and an act of the imagination, I would say.
I'm talking to Rachel Cantor. Her new novel is Good on Paper. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Rachel, I'd love to have you read from the book to us.
Of course. I'm going to read a very short passage, just the opening paragraphs. It's about a page and a half, so you don't need to know anything more than you already do. The first page and a half of Good on Paper. 12,000 envelopes wanted stuffing. There were 12,000 labels to affix. Mr. Ferguson, administrative manager of Legs R Us, had particular ideas about proportional folding and straight affixion. Affliction? Darlene asked. Affixion, I said. Never heard of that, Darlene said. Exactly, I said. Why are you whispering? Darlene asked. I was hiding in the supply closet, but Darlene didn't need to know that. You need to airlift me out of here, I said. You need to stick it out, Shira. I can't keep placing you if you keep quitting jobs. I never managed to stick. I couldn't look at the walls of the schlock gallery. I couldn't bear the boss who kept telling me to smile, or the funny smell in the church office lunchroom. I blamed Clyde. We'd gotten together last spring as the Good Sense Flavor Factory prepared for Winter Wonderland. As a joke, the flavor text threw a holiday party, complete with an inflatable Santa and a menorah for me and the ancient receptionist. Clyde explained over imitation raspberry-flavored eggnog that a woman's sense of smell is more acute than that of a man. Allowed to sniff a variety of sweaty T-shirts, a woman will naturally be attracted to the one with the most compatible DNA. It was only when he dabbed soy sauce behind my ears that I realized I was being seduced. We French kissed under the mistletoe. I guess I liked what I smelled. But that was spring. By summer, Clyde's gal Friday was back, and I was gone. A temp is a temp is a temp, after all. There had been no talk of us or tomorrow. Really? I'd asked while buttoning my top. If the girl needs time off, I'll ask for you, he said. I felt shabby then and out of sorts. Since then, there had been the Falafel Dynasty, the Workers' Museum, the Doll Importer, and now the proportional folding system. I need something different, I told Darlene from the supply closet. Really different. A new start. That's what you said before. I got you a charity. I know, I said. Prosthetic legs, they're important. Sticking is important, she said. Sticking means temp to perm. You do want something permanent, right? You're not one of those folks who thinks the world is going to end by Y2K, are you? It was then I got the call.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Rachel Cantor reading from her new novel, Good on Paper. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And just there, in fact, you mentioned Y2K, which comes back. We have the Nobel laureate Romé faxing her versions of his manuscript. So can you talk some more about choosing that time period and how it echoes in the book?
I should add that even in 1999, when this book takes place, Romé is a little bit behind the times technologically. There was email back then. He could have emailed his work, but faxing was what he was able to do. I actually began this book a long time ago. It was the first book I wrote, even though it was the second that was published. And I started researching it in 2000, and I had the first idea for it in 1999, and only started writing it in the beginning of 2001, which is a long time ago. And then Y2K happened, of course, and I very much did not want this book to be a 9/11 happened, excuse me. I very much didn't want this book to be a 9/11 book. It was not a 9/11 book. I didn't want the New York City that was portrayed in the book to be post 9/11 New York. It really is about a more innocent time, and so I set it before 9/11, and it occurred to me to set it before Y2K. Largely because, I sort of enjoyed the comedic potential of that, but also because all the talk of apocalypse that was going around at that time, the end of days and so on, it had a sort of thematic resonance with the book, in which there's some talk about minor talk. It's not a major aspect of the book, but it had resonance, and so it was in part a practical alternative to either trying to set the book much, much later than 9/11, which I really couldn't do because these characters were set, their ages were set, and their histories were set, so that Romé was a post-World War II refugee. And if I was to set the book in current times, he really couldn't be that. Shira had been a flower child as a young person, and that would change if I changed her birth date. To bring her up to 15 years toward the present. So largely practical concerns, but also just really didn't want a 9/11 story. I thought that would clutter the book. It would be confusing. So
that's interesting. And the faxing just amused me, because I mean, there are the forgotten, but once you mention them, issues of a fax that doesn't come through or that might not be complete, and it's like, oh, we don't have to deal with that anymore.
Well, I'm old enough to remember when faxes were themselves revolutionary technology, and they came through with funny paper and funny smells, but this technology is a little bit more advanced than that.
Right, and in fact, one of the things that Romé wants Shira to fax him is a picture of her child, Andy. And so I was interested to ask you about Andy, because she's only 7, and she's in a lot of scenes of the novel. And there was a Goodreads review that made this comment that kind of stuck with me, that she was a good child character or successful because she was neither too good nor too annoying. and it made me think, are kids harder to write or to make convincing, or maybe they are. And so I'm curious about any special considerations you had for that character, or were you watching out for these pitfalls of annoying?
Well, writing her character came very easily to me, and maybe that's because I'm an auntie. I don't know. I've written before about a seven-year-old. The other novel I had, strangely enough, also featured a seven-year-old. They're at a very special kind of turning point, I find, once I realized that I'd done this more than once, I was able to look back and think about it. But seven-year-olds are at a kind of a funny turning point. They're still cute, but they're on their way to becoming much more idiosyncratic human beings, and they're moving into their less cute phase. And yet they can be extremely articulate, they're thoughtful, they notice everything that's going on. So there's something about that age which really appeals to me. And I don't think I really had any difficulty writing her character. I did have my sister Liz, who's a mother, and also a child psychologist. I had her read the book at a certain phase to just a reality check that a precocious seven-year-old would think and do and say the things that Andy does say. So I got that reality check. I felt convinced that she was realistic, although maybe at the high end of intelligence. I just really didn't have a lot of difficulty writing her. I also have, of course, had an editor who was there to check me if I, check any of my excesses, and she felt free to do that. So it wasn't difficult somehow.
I hope she
comes across as being a character that people like, because I like her an awful lot.
Yeah, no, I think that does come through. I happen to be the mother of a seven-year-old, and so
are you?
I could sense that what you were just saying about her. She is precocious, but she does both. Like any seven-year-old, she has her moments, and that's fun.
She can say the wisest thing at the same time. She can start screaming for no reason, right?
And she gets tired.
And she gets tired and cranky, yes.
I'm talking to Rachel Cantor. Her new novel is Good on Paper. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Changing gears here, on your website, you have links to interviews and some essays, and there was one about your first writer's residency.
In
your acknowledgments, you mentioned quite a few. It's clear that you've done them. And so for our listeners who might be considering going that route or who haven't had the opportunity yet, can you talk about the benefits of engaging with a writer's colony?
Oh, absolutely. I've been to a lot of writer's colonies. I've been the recipient of enormous generosity in that regard. And it's a good thing because I write very, very well in that kind of setting. Basically, a writer's or an artist colony more generally, although there's different kinds, different models of them, but an artist colony in general terms allows you to just sit back and do your writing. Generally speaking, they provide you with some meals, in some cases all meals, in some cases some meals, and you're there in the company of other extraordinary writers and often artists, visual artists, choreographers, filmmakers, translators in some cases, and you have the opportunity then to work without distraction during the day, without any kind of concern, hopefully, for whether you have to do your laundry or whether you have to, go to the grocery store. No, none of that you really have to be concerned about. You just really have to dive as deep as you can into your own work. And then in the evening, you can hang out with other artists and writers and talk about your process or share notes or talk about the movies you loved, whatever it is that's on your mind. And you can make lifelong friendships in this way. You can make important connections for sharing your work with other people. And I find that the quality of work I'm able to do when I'm able to work without distraction for a period of time, and generally speaking, I've been to residencies between 3 weeks and up to 8 weeks. When I started Good on Paper, I was at a residency for 8 weeks. Which is amazing. But the quality of work and the quantity of work that I personally am able to do at such a place is astonishing. And I find that it's true for most people. There's been very, very few instances where I've met a person at a residency, and by now I've met hundreds, who hasn't benefited from being at such a place, who's felt, I could do a better job at home. And it's, it can be especially liberating for people who have children at home, for example, or who live with other people, or who have a day job that they, you know, need to flush out of their system, as it were, so they can get some work done. They're marvelous. And sometimes they've also given me a chance to see other parts of the country or even other parts of the world. It's very something I highly recommend and I very much enjoy doing.
And do you have an MFA?
I have an MA, yeah, from Johns Hopkins Writing Seminars.
Okay. I see. And did comparisons with that experience go through your mind at all when you were at these artist colonies, or was it just so different that it doesn't?
So different. I mean, because in most cases, a colony doesn't involve a learning opportunity in the sense of a workshop. I mean, there are a few that will have that as an aspect of them, but that's really the exception rather than the rule. So that, you know, at MFA, you're engaging with teachers, you're sharing your work and expecting critical feedback, you're reading the work of others. And at a residency, you're really, most cases, you're on your own. You're alone with your work, and you're presumed to be a professional. No one's going to be watching to see what you do or asking how you're doing. You're just there to do your work. And you are free to give a reading at night if you want, but, again, it's not required. So you could be playing solitaire all day long, although I rather expect you won't want to use that opportunity that way. But you're a professional, so you're doing what you need to do to get your work done. So really there are aspects of professional development in a sense, but they're quite different.
Well, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I want to ask you if you have any writing advice for the writers listening.
Well, you know, I don't teach, so I'm not very often asked to give advice. But drawing from my own life, I can say that I have very general advice for new writers who are either very hesitant and or shy, or on the other hand, impatient, I think. For the hesitant people who are worried about sharing work or about sending out work, I want to tell you, just do it. You know, share your work with your peers, find teachers, share your work with your teachers, try new things. Don't let fear of rejection, don't let actual rejection, and don't let the difficulties of writing stop you from doing the work, because it's worth it, and persistence can yield wonderful work. So that's my advice for those who are hesitant to because of fear, basically. And for those of you who are impatient because you just can't wait to see your books out in the world, I would say take it slow. You know, take a lot of time to write and to rewrite. Take time to share your work with other people. Take time to develop and learn about your individual style and your subject matter, what really speaks to you, because chances are the first things you write are not going to be the things you're proud of 10 years later. So you want to submit, but you want to wait until you're really ready and you've read a lot and you've written a lot, because the literary magazines and the publishers and so on will still be there when you're ready. That would be my advice.
Those are good ones, fear and impatience.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, because the fear, that impacts everyone, and it's just every writer's chore to just get over it.
Exactly. Well, yes, and it's not going to go away. You know, it's just something you need to acknowledge, maybe, first of all, and then, you know, tell your fear who's boss. Find ways to, you know, shore yourself up and keep working.
Good. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, Nicole, thank you so much.
That was Rachel Cantor. Her new novel is Good on Paper, published by Melville House Publishing. During the second part of the show, Tracy Robert, author of the interconnected novella Flashcards and The Curse of Ambrosia, will be here. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with novelist Rachel Cantor. Next up, I'll be speaking with author Tracy Robert. Tracy holds the Pirates Alley Faulkner Prize for fiction for a novella and was a finalist for the Flannery O'Connor Award for short fiction. She's also been published in various periodicals and anthologies, including Forever Sisters and When Last on the Mountain. She is a co-founder of Around the Block Writers Collaborative. And her debut book, recently published, is a winner of the Many Voices Project Prize at New Rivers Press. The book is called Flashcards and the Curse of Ambrosia, and I am so pleased to have her here in studio to talk about it. Tracy, hi there.
Hi, I'm happy to be here too.
So, a local author, and you grew up in Southern California.
Yes, I did.
So, would you start us off here by telling us about your book?
Okay, it's a book of linked novellas. The first one, Flashcards, was written many years ago, and it's narrated by Phoebe, and it chronicles the friendship between Phoebe and Dessa. And they're very, very different girls. Phoebe is a little more cerebral than Dessa. Dessa is more into celebrating her body. But nonetheless, they're very good friends. And they help each other through their kind of troubled families. And that book leaves them off as their friendship kind of dissipates at the end of high school. The second novella, The Curse of Ambrosia, is narrated by Dessa, and it reunites the two now women who are in their 80s, late 80s, and the world is quite a different place from, well, what it was when they were children, and they're not that happy with it. And they're still feisty and full of life, and they decide to do something about the world that they don't like much anymore. So...
And as you said, these are two novellas that are linked through these characters.
Right.
And they jump a few decades at the break.
Yeah, quite a few.
And we were discussing earlier whether it was a novel, whether it wasn't a novel, whether it can be structured that way. Did you have that kind of conversation at all with your editors?
No, it never came up. And it was really interesting when you brought it up because I had this one novella for many years. I loved it. I wanted to get it published, and it just was not going to be published without either some short stories that went with it or a sister novella. So that's what I knew I had to do. So I've always thought of them as kind of separate entities, and I wrote the second one as kind of a standalone but related to the first novella. But yeah, they do kind of read like a novel.
They do, and there's this trend these days of interconnected short stories, and as novellas, mm-hmm. they're sort of made up themselves of interconnected short stories, so it's more of a nested structure, but I like calling it a novel.
Okay, you can do that.
Okay. And, of course, I'm going to ask you about setting, because, well, you're from Southern California, and also setting is a major part of the book, and so can you talk a little bit about what setting means to you as a writer and how you incorporate it and what also the role it plays in these stories? Well, let's start with focusing maybe on the first one because we'll get to the second.
Okay. I purposely wrote about suburbia in that first novella, and I wrote about it because I was angry. I had an experience when I first set out to find a master's program, an MFA program. I made it to the interview stage of a pretty prestigious program and went in for the interview. I was in my early 30s, so I was kind of green. And the two men who were interviewing me said, well, we really like your work, but we think it's rather suburban in nature. And we'd like to know what you think about that. And so there I was. I was completely tongue-tied at that point. I knew that if I said, oh, you're absolutely right, it's so suburban, I would be betraying my own work. But if I said, no, I kind of disagree with you, then there go my chances of being in that program. And so I just was, there was an uncomfortably long silence. And finally I said, well, I'm glad nobody asked John Cheever that question. And then I didn't get in, of course. But I just thought, I'm going to write a book that's about suburbia and that has all the pathos and you know, betrayal and redemption and, you know, all things that go into any good book and, you know, the language and everything that I love about writing. And you can do it no matter where you set the book. I happened to pick the place where I grew up, Woodland Hills, because I know it well.
And in the second novella, they take a memorable trip to Orange County.
Yes.
And we should also mention that in the second novella, it takes place in the future.
Right.
And it's a rather dystopian future.
Yes.
And so I'd love to hear about the creation of that dystopia, because it's not by any means a one note. It's very fleshed out, and you have thought about this future society. So can you talk about your imagination working on that?
Yes. I really didn't want to write a dystopian novel. I'm not a big, you know, it's not something that I have wanted to do in my writing, but I wanted to write about Dessa and Phoebe as old women, and that's where they ended up in my mind. A student asked me about this, and I said, I came up with this idea for this particular dystopia because I thought about, well, you know, if a volcano erupted today and we were all caught in our you know, day-to-day postures, what would we look like? And I figured out, well, people would either have their hands up to their ears with their cell phones, or they'd be furiously texting with their thumbs on their cell phones, and that's how we would be frozen in time. And so I thought, well, where would it go from there? You know, where are we going to go with this technology? And I thought, well, we're going to have little devices implanted in ourselves and this and that. And education is going to be, you know, traditional education in classrooms is not going to be anymore. And, but, you know, you can see it's not that, it doesn't take that much to imagine that happening because we already have distance learning. I just took what is going on now and a few steps forward.
Yeah, and also at one point it's 120 degrees outside.
Yeah, well, after this last summer, you know, I didn't find that too hard to believe either. So, unfortunately.
Yeah. I'm talking to Tracy Robert, author of the novel Flashcards and the Curse of Ambrosia. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. So, Tracy, was it depressing to write that dystopia? I'm just curious because I can see how that would happen because it didn't feel... I'm not that I'm a huge connoisseur of dystopian literature. I'm not. I tend to
Nor
kind
am
of
I.
Avoid it.
Yeah.
But this was manageable, I think, maybe because you did ground us in their characters first in a world that I felt totally at home in, and then it made me intrigued to enter that world with them. But
right.
was it depressing? Or?
No. I wanted it to be about the friendship. And for Dessa, who's kind of a cynical loner kind of person, I wanted that friendship, the renewal of that friendship, to change her. And it does. It does change her. So in that sense, it was not depressing for me at all. Also, when I finished writing the second novella, I was in Jamaica. I made a little writer's retreat for myself, and I was teaching at the time, and I had some summer vacation time, and I was just like, I have to get out of here, and I have to finish this book so that I can start, you know, putting it out there. So when I finished writing the novel, I was literally sitting directly over the Caribbean, looking out at the aqua water, and it was a nice antidote to dystopia.
Oh, I could imagine. Tracy, I'd love to have you read to us from the book.
Okay. This is a section of the first novella, Flashcards, where Phoebe catalogs her mother's drunken afternoon shenanigans. For privacy, the houses in our neighborhood had masonite slats woven through their chain-link fences. From above, these must have resembled a continuous protective membrane between clustered cells. If you wanted to spy, You couldn't be nonchalant about it. You had to purposely climb and gaze boldly into someone else's backyard. Laird Benwell, our next-door neighbor, mounted the ladder beside his yacht, the Edith Marie, named for his wife well before its completion, and stared down at us. There was a joke among my mother's woman friends that Benwell's yacht got to be oversized and took him so long to construct because he wanted an excuse to spy on my mother when she potted daisies or lay in the sun, and that he named it after his wife to appease her jealousy. I disliked Benwell for a number of reasons, not the least of which was that he dumped Tokyo Rose, his family's pet, at the Humane Society. He claimed the monkey was the cause of his son's perennial colds, but he'd actually got rid of her shortly after she escaped her cage and hung upside down from our roof in front of the kitchen window. My mother, doing the dishes, had run screaming into the front drive, flailing her scrub cloth like a flag of distress. "Hey, Sandy," he yelled now from over the fence. He was the only person I knew who imposed a nickname on my mother. She and Pierce tossed a tennis ball in a soggy game of keep away from the dog. Valari twirled and snapped at the challenge, his black curls whipping more spray into the air. Pierce laughed rapid fire at the dog's acrobatics. The sprinklers hissed. My mother couldn't have heard Laird Benwell if she'd wanted to. He resorted to me. "Some heat wave we're having, eh, Feebariba?" "Yeah, Mr. Benwell," I said. "Pretty hot, all right." "Oops," he said, wagging his hammer at me. "Remember, it's Dr. Benwell." He was a chiropractor, about whom my father said, "The man's not an M.D., and I won't have my children spouting his lies." So we had license to be taciturn, though not overtly rude, with Benwell and his admonitions. I tipped my book and nodded at Mr. Benwell. "Looks like your mom's found a way to beat the weather." He regarded her with an eager expression he'd never worn before today, which induced me to take another glance at my mother. She was fairly well soaked from the sprinklers by now, her page boy sleek to her head as a seal's pelt. The cones of her bra collapsed into the circles of their stitching, and her nylon underpants clung like opaque sandwich wrap. Wisps and curls of hair formed a relief map that I guessed intrigued Benwell, and his probable interest made me feel both protective and ashamed of my mother. She and Pierce hung by their hands from a tree limb, poking their toes at the leaping dog. I picked up my camera and snapped a picture of Benwell, gargoyle leering above the fine spray. He began to pound nails intently. I photographed my mother and brother kicking in midair. I turned and shot my mother's yellow romper, bunched like a cake decoration on the dull concrete patio. I made sure Benwell was still hammering before I went into the house.
Thank you. That was Tracy Robert reading from her book, Flashcards and the Curse of Ambrosia. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And I love that you chose that section. It's a memorable scene that you paint, and it's very, I think, indicative of Phoebe's childhood and her level of observation. And we learn in the second half that, in fact, Phoebe goes on to make a life of studying happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the author of this character, did you learn anything about happiness in having her make these explorations?
Well, I think it's kind of all of our objectives in life to learn about happiness and, you know, what prevents it and what, you know, helps it along. With Phoebe and with all the characters in the book, I think it's their connections that bring them happiness more than anything else. And, you know, that I think that's a major theme that runs throughout, despite the difficulties of being in relationships with people.
Right. And she does have to, we learn at the outset of the second novella that she has to repair things with Dessa, that there has been a rift.
Oh, yeah. Dessa is, she's kind of being rescued by Phoebe in the second novella, and she resents it. But I think there's a point at which she realizes that even though she has a few resentments of Phoebe, that Phoebe has enriched her life, you know. And I think that's true with all very, very close relationships. And you learn what fights you're going to pick and what you have to just say, well, this is the price I pay for being close to this person or this family.
Right. And there are a lot of consequences in this book. I mean, it's for Dessa, I thought it was hilarious. I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to mention that she has an old, what are they called, EV5 or the Toyota?
It's an electric car.
Yeah, yeah.
The one that kind of went out of production. Yeah. She keeps it downstairs in a garage plugged in. And there aren't many cars on the road at this juncture of the U.S. So, yeah. I forget where we were going with this.
Oh, I was just thinking, because with Dessa, she's had these two marriages and she's had these jobs, and it's an interesting life, a combination of failures and successes, and like you were saying, how she comes to have to rely on Phoebe for this next stage in her life, that it's a compromise, but it's a very relatable one. I mean, because of the situations after living a lifetime we find ourselves in, of some victories and some...
Right. And there's also the child that she had, that she kind of addresses a lot of her musings and, you know, discoveries to him as she comes out of her loneliness and as she develops relationships with the old friends that are now her new friends.
And I thought that was a really interesting conceit, especially with the dystopian setting in the future, because then you realize you have to reconcile the loss with the advantages of the child not experiencing this dystopia, and how bad is it, and just adding that. Did you always have those addresses to the deceased?
No. They just kind of came about. I wanted there to be something, some like really powerful loss in Dessa's life, because I think that people, when they go through that, it opens them up. And I think it opened Dessa up. I'm not sure she would have been quite so open to renewing her friendships had that not happened. I think somebody once told me you have to be broken open in order to start sharing yourself, and that's how I envisioned her, and that was a loss that she had. And also, I do hear quite a bit of this sort of thing nowadays with people talking about, well, when I was a child, I played outside. My parents weren't afraid that I was going to be abducted and all this stuff. And it's that sort of thing.
I'm talking to Tracy Robert, author of the book Flashcards and the Curse of Ambrosia. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Tracy, you are part of this writers collective that you've co-founded.
Mm-hmm.
With the background as an English teacher, can you talk just a bit about forming the collective and what it is?
Yeah, it's we call it Around the Block Writers Collaborative, and I formed it with two of my very good friends from grad school. We were teaching at the Chautauqua Institute for a number of years. It was kind of like a reunion for us during the summer. And we then decided, well, why can't we just sort of go international with this? And so we planned destination workshops, and we've done them in... the first one we did was in Jamaica, then we did one in Dublin, Ireland. We've actually done a couple there, a couple in Jamaica. Recently did one in Cortona, Italy, in Tuscany, and we're heading out to Bali in March to do another one.
Wow. Well, we're running down on our time, but especially with your experience as a teacher of students of all ages, I understand.
Yes.
What insight about writing and getting over the fear that our previous guest mentioned? How do we get to our best work?
Well, I would say you have to remember that any act of creation is messy. You know, I mean, when you bake a cake, it's messy. When a baby's born, it's messy. When you build a house, it's messy. And it's the same with creating a book or a story or a poem. It's going to look like a mess. And if you're a perfectionist, that mess is going to bother you, and you have to get over that. So I think that you have to be both demanding of yourself and forgiving of yourself. Demanding in that you have to, like, sit yourself down in front of the mess every day and go, okay, I'm going to make more mess today. And then forgiving because you know that eventually you're going to turn that mess into something good.
Well, Tracy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was author Tracy Robert. Her book, Flashcards and the Curse of Ambrosia, is out and published by New Rivers Press. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for Filling the Voids with Natalia, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.